Chapter 14. Max. Heidelberg, Germany, August 1913. Clover Bar, Hither Green, London, August 2nd, 1913. My dearest Max. Oh, Max, I am spinning. I so wish you could have been at the suffragist rally in Hyde Park this past Saturday. Over 50,000 people. It was in the London Illustrated News today. A full page with photographs. I could see Jessie and me in the crowd, listening to Mrs. Fawcett's speech. I've been in the papers, Max. What do you think of that? Quite a sea of people. Women, mostly, of course, but not a few supportive men as well. The government can't possibly ignore us now. I bumped into that young auctioneer I told you about, Frank Jeffries, carrying Esther Clothier's banner from the Somerset Society. He said he was quite for women's right to vote, and managed to escape the auction house for a few hours to attend the rally. I must say, I was rather impressed. You must never judge a book by its cover. Jessie and I took the train down to Brighton on the 19th to join up with the marchers there. I was quite cross with Etta for not coming with us, but she was off to yet another gallery opening, which she insisted she couldn't miss. She has been like a hummingbird, flitting in and out of the house for the past few months. She says she is educating her artistic eye, whatever that means. She's taken to wrapping her head in a headscarf and sticking an ostrich feather in it for good measure. She is quite the sight. But Mama says nothing, and Papa indulges her no end. She had an escapade last month, where she stayed out 2 hours after she was meant to be home, and arrived back in a taxi, accompanied by an Italian. Mama and Papa were very vexed, yet here we are, a fortnight later. And it is as if nothing happened. Etta has them both twisted around her little finger. Jessie and I shake our heads and simply carry on. At least I can count on Jessie. She's quite a solid type, and has just graduated top of her nursing class. We are so very proud of her, though she's having quite a time of it with Mama right now, as she's determined to become a nurse for the British Army. Mama has threatened to burn her uniform if she does so. Papa and I spend most of our time in the photography studio, as their arguments and silences are quite a trial to bear. I know Jessie, and Mama hasn't a hope to change her mind. Stubborn as mules, both of them. The march up from Brighton was quite an adventure. I brought the brownie camera Papa gave me for my birthday and took loads of photographs. We walked all the way to London, staying in tents on our journey, and held rallies each evening once we'd reached our daily destination. It was all quite jolly, with more and more people joining us along the way, though I did have one lady tip a pot of dried tea leaves over my head from her window in Cookfield. I expect she thought I would be cross, but they smelled lovely, and I waved and thanked her for the fragrant shower. We reached London on the 26th and assembled in Kennington, where more local people joined us. At 4 o'clock, we headed toward Hyde Park. If I were a bird, what a view I would have had! Rivers of women carrying our red, green and white banners through the streets. Whatever must Mr. Asquith have thought as he watched us march past his window in the Parliament building? We had speakers speaking at 19 platforms, and at 6 o'clock a vote was taken on the motion that this meeting demands a government measure for the enfranchisement of women. It was passed unanimously. Unanimously, Max! I kissed poor Jessie and jumped about like a banshee. So much for being the quiet girl. I so wish you could have been there. Mr. Asquith has agreed to receive a deputation on August the 8th, and Mrs. Fawcett has asked me to be part of the group. I am so very excited. I feel like my life is coming alive. To have purpose, real purpose. I can hear you across the North Sea. But you wish to teach German, Schatzi, don't you? Isn't that a purpose? Yes, of course it is, and I still wish that. But Mrs. Fawcett has helped me see that there is so much more I can do. We are on the cusp of the government passing a women's suffrage bill, and I've had a role in that. Oh, my dear Max, I have rabbited on. Please, tell me more about life in Heidelberg. How is your little stepbrother, Hans? Still getting up to mischief, I expect. I'm glad to hear he is well recovered from his skiing mishap last winter. Are you travelling to the mountains again this summer? I imagine them full of pine trees and goats, with air as pure as rainwater. Only 4 more weeks, Max. Has it really been over 2 months since we've seen each other? You haven't forgotten me, have you? Your loving Schatzi. Max folds the pages of the letter and slips them between Acts 1 and 2 of All's Well That Ends Well in the Heidelberg University's library copy of the complete works of Shakespeare. He sits down at the small wooden desk in his bedroom and takes a sheet of paper from the drawer. A flash of black and white in the cherry tree outside his window catches his eye. A magpie hops amongst the branches, nudging the ripening cherries with its beak. One for sorrow. Max scans the branches, searching for another flash of black and white in the thick foliage. One for sorrow. A second magpie alights on a branch near the treetop. Max smiles. Two for joy. He unscrews the cap of his fountain pen and bends his head over the sheet of white paper. Sandgasse 10, Heidelberg, Germany. August 20th, 1913. My dear Schatzi, you are wondering what happened to me, I am sure. I have just arrived back in Heidelberg from Garmisch-Partenkirchen in the Bavarian mountains with my mother and my stepfather and little Hans. I have taken a great many photographs with my new Brownie camera. I am very glad you suggested I buy one. My stepfather is a keen hiker, so we were out in the mountains almost every day, and Hans climbed up the hills like a goat in his new lederhosen, of which he is so proud. I am quite fit now, though I have been dreaming about Frau Knopfler's plum tart. My mouth is watering as I'm thinking of it. I'm so happy your march has been a success. I had no doubt about it. You are so clever, Schatzi. Anything you put your mind to, you will succeed in. I am sure of it. Enough with all the politeness. I miss you, my Schatzi, like the flowers miss the spring rain. You are in my dreams every night. It is the only world in which I am truly happy. It has been so very long. Even though I have kept myself busy, each morning when I wake up and remember that I shall not see your smiling face, my happiness drains away, and I know I must somehow find the courage to meet the day. I shall be arriving at the train station on the 7th at 4 o'clock. My heart is beating like a drum in my chest as I think about it. I shall be standing on the platform with my hat in my hands, watching the crowd for you and your lovely red hair under a big hat. Why do girls wear such big hats, Schatzi? I love your hair. Have I ever told you that? I think I haven't. It is the colour of the twilight sky as the sun sets over the Neckar River. When I am in Heidelberg, I walk up the Philosophen Weg and sit on the stone wall and watch the sun set over the old town. I watch as it turns the sky the colour of your hair. Your loving Max. Chapter 15. Jessie. King's College Hospital, London, August 1913. Jessie plumps the pillow for the boy in bed 12 in the paediatrics ward, whose right leg is buried in a plaster cast, which is strung up onto a pulley over his bed.
Jessie!
Jessie looks up to see Elsie charging across the polished green linoleum.
Matron's looking for you. There's been an automobile accident. She wants you in surgery.
But I've been assigned to paediatrics.
Doesn't matter. She wants you there, quick as you like.
Jessie rushes after Elsie into the hallway. They push through a pair of swing doors and rush down the stairs to the ground floor. Elsie waves at Jessie in front of the operating theatre doors.
See you at lunch in the caf, Jessie. You can tell me all about it.
Sure. Save me some salmon loaf. Inside the operating theatre, the matron gestures to Jessie. Scrub up, Sister Fry. We'll be assisting Mr. Goodfellow. Nurses and orderlies fly about in a frenzy, wheeling in trolleys of equipment and preparing the operating theatre. Jessie grabs the soap and lathers her hands under a tap. Sister Webb said there'd been an automobile accident. Yes, the matron says, as she ties on a surgical mask. They'll license any fool to drive one of those abominations, careering all over the roads at 20 miles an hour. Thoroughfares were never meant to be used by people travelling at the rate of trains. They've only gone and ploughed into a mother and her son, stepping off an omnibus on Lewisham High Street. The swing doors slam open, and two orderlies wheel in a trolley, bearing a woman screeching, Simon! Simon! The matron points to a space beside a wall. Over there. The doors swing open again. Trolley with a young boy this time. The matron gestures to the opposite wall. Jessie ties the mask over her capped head as she joins the matron. The boy lies still, as if he is sleeping, a seeping bandage tied around his head, his school uniform splattered with blood. The matron lifts the boy's wrist, feeling for a pulse. She opens his left eyelid, then his right. Then she rests the boy's hand on his grey uniform jacket. She steps across the polished linoleum floor to the distraught woman, who is clutching a torn sheet, sodden with blood, that someone has tied across her stomach. The woman grabs the nurse's grey sleeve with a bloody hand.
Simon! Where's my son?
He's here. He's sleeping. A groan escapes the woman's pale lips.
Take care of him. He's all I have.
He's in good hands. The best. Jessie sits on a stool by the dead boy. She has drawn a sheet over his body, but holds his cold hand under the thin white cotton. The matron enters the room and glances at Jessie as she peels off the rubber gloves and tosses them into a bin.
We didn't even try, matron.
The matron turns on the tap. We saved his mother.
But we didn't even try with him. He's just a boy, with his whole life ahead of him.
He was dead, Sister Fry. There was nothing we could do.
Maybe he was in shock. Maybe we made a mistake.
The matron lathers her hands with yellow soap. You mean, maybe I made a mistake? It was triage, Sister Fry. You need to assess the casualties and make a decision as to whom to prioritise for treatment. You often don't have more than 20 seconds to do that. Believe me, you hope to God you don't make a mistake. She turns off the tap and wipes her hands on a towel. The boy had no pulse. He wasn't breathing. His pupils were dilated. He was dead. There was nothing we could do for him. But we could save his mother.
She said he was all he had.
Our job is to mend people. We mended her.
But she...
When you are on the front line after a battle, and the casualties lie on stretchers in their hundreds, your job will be to triage and to mend. That is what an army nurse does. It is for Mr. Freud and Mr. Jung to address the patient's psychological states. The matron rests her hand on Jessie's shoulder. Are you quite certain you wish to be an army nurse? I understand you are popular in paediatrics. It's not too late to change your mind. Jessie releases the boy's hand.
I haven't changed my mind. I want to help as many soldiers as I can. I want to be an army nurse. Now, more than ever.
Chapter 16. Christina. Capri, Italy. August 1891. Christina tucks her booted feet underneath her, wishing she could untie the laces and release her feet to the summer air and the cool grass in the shade of the parasol pine. If she were on her own, she would. She pops a fat grape into her mouth, savouring the juicy sweetness as she chews. The good-humoured arguments of the housekeeper, Liliana Sabatini, and her husband, Angelo, waft over to her from the picnic blanket, where her cousin sits under a parasol reading a novella. Angelo's donkey flaps its ears at a persistent fly, then bends its head to the grass. Christina spits the grape seeds into her palm and drops them into the long grass.
Tina, use your handkerchief. You are not a fishwife.
Sorry, Cugina.
Harry chuckles as he dabs his paintbrush at the canvas he has set on an easel under the tree. He frowns.
This is no good. I need you to take off your hat, Christina.
But, Harry, it's so hot. My nose will go red.
Please, Christina, if you stay in the shade, you'll be fine. It's such a shame not to see your hair.
All right. Not for long, though.
She unpins the straw hat and sets it on the grass beside her. Harry holds up the paintbrush and gestures like an orchestra conductor.
Turn your head that way, facing the sea. Perfect.
You're very bossy.
Christina glances at Harry, who has rolled the sleeves of his white shirt and loosened the knot in his tie. His skin has turned tan from the summer sun, and his somewhat thick-set build is slimmer than she remembers from their first meeting.
Had that only been 2 months ago? It was strange how the days in the sun could feel endless, yet the months could pass so quickly. Was it only a week ago that he had kissed her in the grotto?
Her heart flutters as she remembers the warmth of his body against hers, his hands on her shoulders, the kiss, soft like the touch of a butterfly's wings at first, then hotter and stronger, until she'd been lost in the mindless sensation of his searching mouth. She should feel guilty, but she doesn't. She catches Harry's eye, and he smiles, a beam of sunlight sharpening the blue of his eyes. He waggles the paintbrush at her.
Turn around.
Sorry.
You are a very difficult subject.
It's just so hard to sit still on such a beautiful day.
I'll take you for a walk later. There are some Roman ruins up on Mount Tiberio.
Her heart skips a beat. They hadn't been alone together since the grotto.
A mountain?
It's more like a tall hill. We'll take our time. There are some lovely views along the way. Oh, and goats.
Goats?
Mountain goats. They're very friendly.
She glances sideways at her cousin.
I'm not sure Cousin Stefania will be up for a long walk up a mountain.
Ah, yes. Our chaperone.
Harry turns to the Italian woman, who has nodded off under the parasol, a book still in her hand.
Cugina Stefania!
Liliana knocks Stefania's foot with her black shoe.
Stefania, svegliati!
Stefania snorts awake.
What? What is it?
Cugina Stefania, Harry says. We're going for a walk up to the Roman ruins on Mount Tiberio later. Would you like to come?
Stefania looks around the group, blinking the sleep from her eyes.
Everyone is going? Well, everyone is invited.
Stefania's eyebrows draw together over her Roman nose like an arrow.
It's much too far in this heat. We shall go back to the villa and have a rest.
Christina twists around.
Oh, please. I'm not in the least tired. We've been sitting here for hours.
Stefania flaps the book beside her cheek.
Fine. You English and your walks. Angelo will go with you. Liliana must come back with me to make dinner.
Angelo secures the easel onto the donkey's back with the panniers
as Harry gives instructions to Liliana for the best way to carry the wet painting back to the villa. They wave Stefania and Liliana on their way, with a promise to be back by 6 o'clock. When they reach the piazzetta, Harry takes Angelo aside and, after a whispered consultation, resulting in the exchange of several handfuls of Harry's lira for Angelo's water flask and a pat on his back, Harry and Christina are free of their chaperone. Christina watches Angelo depart, and her stomach quivers. Perhaps she should go back to the villa with him. Then Harry slips her hand into the crook of his elbow, and the warmth of his body sends a thrill of joy through her that obliterates any doubt. They head down the narrow cobbled alley of the Via Longano, past the shoemakers, the bakery and the butchers, where two fresh rabbits hang on a hook outside the door. They turn right onto Via Sopramonte, where the undulating cobbled path takes them past villa walls draped with vibrant bougainvillea. After half an hour, they reach the turn into the even narrower Via Tiberio, where the plastered villa walls become rough stone dwellings, until even these signs of civilization disappear at the base of the mount. They stop to drink the last of the water from Angelo's flask, and, after Harry loops the leather strap over his head, he reaches for Christina's hand. "I know a place with a beautiful view. Let's go there first." Christina smiles. She's so happy. She feels like her heart is about to burst with joy. "That sounds lovely." They continue up the narrow dirt path, under the wind-whipped pines and columnal cypresses, hand in hand, saying nothing. At the end of the winding path, they break through the shade of the pines, out onto a rocky outcrop. Christina gasps. At this height, it is as if she is a bird in the endless blue sky. The fishing boats are nothing but dots on the vast blue sea below, and the wake of the Naples ferry draws a white line in the direction of the mainland. "Oh, Harry, it's incredible." Her heart beats a drum in her chest. Then his arms are around her, and she disappears into his endless kisses. "Come with me, Christina." She grasps Harry's hand and follows him past the ancient ruined walls, half buried under scrub grass and vines. He releases her hand as he scrambles over an uneven step and enters through what would have once been a doorway into a small, roofless room. She hesitates for a moment, her foot poised between advancing and fleeing. She knows she should turn back, that it is wrong to be alone here with Harry. But the thundering beat of her heart muffles the warnings, knowing that something momentous is about to happen. She steps across the ancient stones into his embrace, and he holds her against his chest until she feels the beating of their hearts unify. He runs the back of his fingers along the skin of her cheek and attempts to remove her straw hat. She laughs and pushes his hands away, watching him watch her as she draws out the hatpin and sets the hat down on an outcrop of the decaying wall. She closes her eyes as he traces her face with his fingers. He kisses her, kisses like none she has ever given or received. "Christina," he whispers, and it is the sound of a voice in a dream. He presses his hands against the layers of fabric and lace shielding her body from his touch. She can feel his desire despite the barrier of her corset, but she does nothing to stop him. Gasping, he stumbles away from her and wipes at the sweat beading on his forehead. "I'm sorry, Christina. I shouldn't. We mustn't." She stares at him from the shadows. It's not too late to stop. They can simply turn around and go back to the villa, like nothing has happened. Nothing, except that her world has exploded into a million pieces, to be replaced by a love for Harry that glows inside her like the sun. She shuts her eyes and takes several deep breaths. Then she reaches out her hand.
Part 2 1914 Chapter 17 Christina Sussex, England, April 1914 A shaft of sunlight breaks through the branches of the hornbeams and thick-trunked oaks, illuminating the tender new leaves in a phosphorescent glow. At the foot of the trees, blue-violet bluebells spread over the decaying leaves, like a lake pushing at the boundaries of its banks. Christina rests her left hand on the moss-coated wood of the fence as she watches her husband adjust the tripod. In a nearby branch, a bird trills a pretty song. Christina searches the branches until she spots the red breast of a robin. It's a lovely day, Gerald. I'm glad you persuaded me to come down to Sussex. It's so nice to get out of London into the countryside at this time of year. Gerald squints into the viewfinder. He twists the lens as he looks at Christina.
I thought you'd enjoy it, my dear. It's been such a long time since we had a jaunt out on our own.
Christina adjusts the new black straw hat that she's had the milliner dress with yellow silk daffodils and a wide white ribbon.
Yes, well, the girls are all so busy now. Cecilia with her suffragette activities and her German lessons. Jessica at the hospital all hours and Etta.
Christina shakes her head, setting the yellow daffodils quivering.
Honestly, Gerald, I don't know how she persuaded you to permit her to work at the Amiga workshops. She should be concentrating on her art studies at the Slade. Heaven knows it costs enough to send her there.
I thought it would teach her a sense of fiscal responsibility. At least she can pay for her own hair ribbons now. Christina runs her hand over her ear. I'm not at all happy with the people she's coming into contact with at Amiga, Gerald. They're bohemians. I didn't raise my daughter to become a bohemian. And Cecilia, I am not the least happy with her relationship with this Maximilian Fischer. She has been talking about him for over a year now, and we still haven't met him.
That's easy enough to resolve, Tina. Have Celia invite him to Sunday lunch. Her birthday's only a few weeks away. Why not then?
Cecilia's birthday lunch?
Yes, why not? You said you wanted to meet him, didn't you?
Yes, though I haven't a clue what to speak to a German about.
I've always found the weather useful in most situations.
He smiles at his wife. She can be obstinate, but he knows it comes from a place of love. He simply wishes he could break through the wall she's kept around herself all these years. There are moments when he glimpses a softer Christina, the Christina he'd first met, when her eyes light up at the sound of Celie singing at the piano, or a smile tugs at her lips at his unexpected gift of her favourite chocolate cannoli. He wishes it were more often, but he is happy that it happens at all. He holds up the shutter release cable and smiles at his stylish wife. How was a simple man like him so lucky to have married her?
That's perfect, my dear. Don't move.
Christina packs away the leftover cheese and biscuits into the picnic hamper and looks over at her husband, whose soft snores are already resonating from beneath the straw hat. 22 years married in November. 22 years since he'd rescued her. Gerald is a good man. He has provided well for her and the girls. She'd done the right thing marrying him. She wishes only that she could love him a little more. She's tried, of course, but love isn't like water. One could not turn it on like a tap. Still, she has no right to complain. Her life is entirely satisfactory, though it is far from the life she'd imagined that summer in Capri, when the world was full of possibilities. When she was young and carefree and happy. The summer that love chose to wrap itself around her like a beautiful cloak. The summer of Harry Grenville. She lies back on the blanket and watches the clouds puff above her in the soft blue sky. Her heart may not throb with the passion she had felt for Harry, and she may not quake with anticipation at the sound of Gerald's step, but her life is perfectly acceptable. She has no reason to complain, and every reason to be thankful. She had prayed to God for her salvation, and he had sent her Gerald. She reaches across to her husband and closes her fingers around his sleeping hand. For that, she is thankful. Chapter 18. The Fries, Clover Bar, London, 3rd of May, 1914.
You made it!
Max removes his bowler hat and sneaks a quick peck on Celia's cheek.
I did. I confess I am rather nervous, Shatzi.
Celia takes Max's umbrella and ushers him into the house.
Don't worry. We don't bite. Well, I can't vouch for Mama.
She pulls the brocade curtain across the door and drops the umbrella into the brass stand.
Isn't the weather dreadful? I was hoping we could have my birthday lunch in the garden, but it's as cold as November out there. Another typical English bank holiday weekend, I'm afraid.
Max slides a small box wrapped in blue paper and a white ribbon into her hand.
Happy birthday, Shatzi. Any day I can spend with you is a bright day for me.
Oh, Celie, isn't that the most charming thing to say?
Etta flies down the staircase in a swirl of shell-pink chiffon.
You are every bit as handsome as Celie said, Max Fisher. I have no idea why she's been hiding you all this time. Etta! Well, it's true, Celie.
Etta takes hold of Max's arm.
Come inside and sit with me, Max, and tell me all about how you met Celie.
Etta, please, Celie protests, as she hangs Max's raincoat and hat on the coat stand.
Let Max catch his breath. Oh, Celie, I'm simply curious. There's nothing wrong with that, is there, Max?
Indeed not. I am most happy to oblige, Miss Etta.
See, Celie, he's happy to oblige.
That's because he's a gentleman. Celie follows them into the sitting room and sits in her mother's armchair. She gestures to Etta.
Max, this is Etta. Etta, Max.
Mama says Etta has no sense of propriety, and there are times I would agree. Gerald enters the room, his pipe cupped in his left hand.
Did I hear the doorbell, Celie? Ah, Mr. Fisher, you've found us.
He extends his hand to Max, who springs to his feet.
Delighted you could join us for Celie's birthday. 22 already. Where does the time go?
21, Papa.
21, is it, Pet?
He smiles at Max as they shake hands.
I've never been very good at keeping track of time.
It's a pleasure to meet you, Mr. Fry.
I hope you're hungry. Millie has cooked up roast lamb with Christina's Italian cake for pudding.
Gerald sits in his armchair and sucks at his pipe. He frowns as he knocks it against the table.
Drat! It's gone out again, and I've left my matches in the study.
I should hope so, Gerald, Christina says, as she enters the room, slender and elegant in her new navy silk day dress. A family gathering is no place to smoke your pipe. Celie springs out of her mother's chair.
Mama, may I introduce Max Fisher? Max, this is my mother.
Max bows his head.
It is my great honour to meet you, Mrs. Fry. Thank you for inviting me here to share Celie's birthday with your family.
Christina inclines her head, like a queen acknowledging a subject. Cecilia was most insistent, which was quite out of character for her. She is not normally one to exhibit such vigour. Celie glances at Max, embarrassed, though unsurprised, by her mother's comment.
Where's Jessie, Mama? She's not usually one to miss Torta Caprese.
Christina takes a seat in her chair.
She's had to go in to the hospital. On a Sunday?
It would seem so, Cecilia. More cake for us, then, Etta says. I'll go see how Millie's getting on. I can't miss my chance at the icing bowl.
Celie sits beside Max on the chaise longue. Max has been teaching German at the college for... How long is it now, Max?
Almost 2 years. It has been most enjoyable, and it has given me a good opportunity to improve my English.
Christina settles a cool gaze on Max.
Will you be staying in London for long, Mr. Fisher?
I am afraid I must return to Heidelberg at the end of the summer term. I must do my National Army service for the next year.
So you will be leaving London shortly?
Gerald knocks the cold pipe ash into the aspidistra pot.
Tina, my dear, don't chase the poor man away.
I am certain our guest is quite ready to return to his home, Gerald. London can be quite grey and tedious. Is that not so, Mr. Fisher?
Max glances at Celie. Heidelberg is a beautiful city, Mrs. Fry, but then so is London, in its own way. He rests his hand over Celie's. I intend to return as soon as I finish my military service. You see, Celie and I.
Military service?
Yes, Mrs. Fry. I must do it for a year from September. It's a requirement.
Etta pokes her head around the sitting room door.
Hurry up, everyone. Millie has the lamb on the table for carving. The mint sauce smells like heaven. And wait till you see the birthday cake. Jessie will be lucky if there's any left when we're through.
Celie fingers the delicate coral necklace as she and Max walk down Springback Road toward Hither Green train station.
Thank you for the lovely gift, Max. I hope it wasn't dear.
It is my pleasure, Shazi. Please, don't worry about such things. You can't know how excited I was to give it to you. When I saw it, I could not imagine anyone else who would look as well in it.
I'm sorry if Mama was... Well, I did say that she can be rather difficult at times.
Don't worry, Shazi. Your mother is your mother. I must respect her. She is a charming hostess.
You haven't been to many social occasions, have you?
Max chuckles.
I have been to enough. Your mother is only being protective of her daughter. I am a dubious foreigner, after all.
Mama's half Italian, so she should know better than to put you on the spot like that.
I'm so embarrassed she asked you where your loyalties lie if war were to break out in Europe.
Thank goodness for Papa and his cigars. Tell me, Max, what's a cigar like? Is it pleasant?
Mama thinks they're horrid and refuses to let Papa smoke them anywhere except in his study.
Did you have a nice chat with him in there?
I did. He was quite interested in which types of roses grew along the Philosophen Weg.
Surely you didn't talk only about roses?
He glances sideways at Celie.
No, not entirely. I must say, your sister is delightful.
Everyone loves Etta. She breezes around like a colourful bird. She doesn't listen to a word, Mama says, and is consequently Mama's favourite.
I, on the other hand, never seem to please Mama, no matter how hard I try.
I am sure that is not the case, Shazi.
If only that were true.
I'm sorry I missed meeting Jessie, Max says, as they skirt around a puddle.
Just imagine Etta's complete opposite.
Celie stops in front of the modest brick train station.
We're here.
We are indeed.
Max leans forward to kiss her on the cheek, but Celie turns her head and their lips meet. Then they are in each other's arms, oblivious to the Sunday day trippers streaming in and out of the station. Two lovers engulfed in the endless moment before parting.
Where is everyone?
Christina looks up from her needlepoint.
Your father is in his study,
and Etta is in her bedroom, no doubt experimenting with another hairstyle.
Celie sits on the chaise longue.
So, what did you think of Max, Mama?
Christina winces as she pricks her finger on the embroidery needle. He seemed fine.
Fine? Is that all?
Christina presses her finger against her thumb to stem the bleeding.
What do you expect me to say, Cecilia? He was here for a few hours and was no doubt on his best behaviour. I can scarcely be expected to form a clear picture of his character based on one short meeting.
Celie hands her mother her handkerchief.
Papa seemed to like him. They were in his study smoking cigars for an hour.
Men and their cigars. I shall never understand it.
Etta liked him as well.
Etta likes everyone. She has no sense of judgment.
Why do you indulge Etta so much, Mama?
Christina sticks the needle through the canvas and rests the needlepoint on her lap.
Whatever do you mean, Cecilia?
You had Cousin Roger sponsor her place at the Slade, for instance, when you don't even like artists, or Cousin Roger, for that matter. You say artists are self-centred and irresponsible, and yet you did everything you could to secure her place.
One can't help one's nature, Cecilia, and Etta has an artistic nature. Besides, an artistic woman is considered by society to be refined, whereas an artistic man is considered suspect. Roger has assured me that the majority of students at the Slade are female, and that he will keep a close eye on Etta at the Amiga workshops to ensure nothing untoward occurs.
Why have you been so dismissive of me studying German?
I do not object to your studying German, Cecilia, though I can't say I understand your interest in it. I object to you studying German with that man.
With Max? Why?
Cecilia, the way you looked at him through lunch today, hanging on his every word like a lapdog, it was most unseemly. A lady shows restraint and composure at all times.
I'm sorry, Mama. I was just so excited to have him finally meet the family.
Christina tucks Celie's handkerchief in her pocket and picks up the needlepoint. My one consolation is that it won't be repeated any time soon.
What do you mean?
Christina frowns at the turquoise wool she is attempting to thread through the needle.
Isn't Mr. Fisher returning to Germany shortly?
In September. He's teaching at the college through the summer term. I thought I might take his class in advanced German, and we could all go on a family picnic on Wimbledon Common. Wouldn't that be nice?
Really, Cecilia, you lack sense and foresight. Just like a
Christina stabs the thread through the canvas.
Just like my father?
Just like your family. Your sisters. Dreamers, all of you. Dreams result only in disappointment and unhappiness. You're the eldest, Cecilia. Show some sense and be an example to the twins. Teach German if you must. Marry a nice young Englishman and have a family. It is a perfectly reasonable aspiration. Why must I have such wilful daughters?
She pushes the needle through the canvas.
All of this nonsense has given me a headache. I shall tell Millie to make a pot of chamomile tea.
Millie's left. It's her half day.
Celie rises from the chaise longue.
I'll do it. At least I know how to make a reasonable cup of tea. I'm not entirely a lost cause.
Chapter 19. Etta. Amiga Workshops, London. June 1914. Etta teeters on the wooden stepladder as she finishes painting a large pink circle on the showroom ceiling.
Oh, do hold on, Violet. The lad is shaking. I'll drop the brush on your head if you don't hold me steady.
Violet braces the wooden legs with her feet.
Do you suppose the King and Queen would have us paint pink circles on the ceilings of Buckingham Palace?
Etta laughs as she steps down the ladder.
After their reaction to our sitting room display at the Ideal Home Show last autumn, I hardly think so. What was it the paper said? Etta puts on a pompous, clipped accent.
Their Majesties deemed it the perfect example of how not to decorate a sitting room.
Their Majesties are bourgeois. No publicity is bad publicity, Violet, as Mr. Barnum said. And it did draw people into the shop like flies. We did a sterling trade in Mrs. Bell's tea cosies for Christmas presents.
Violet folds up the ladder and sets it against a rack stacked with geometric pattern fabrics in vibrant yellows, mauves and teal blues.
We would have sold more of the table runners and napkins if you'd remembered to order the linen in time for us to paint and sew them, Etta. Roger was quite cross about that.
I know. It's why he wouldn't let me work on the Chinese room at Lady Hamilton's London house. I'm afraid it slipped my mind. There was so much happening last autumn with the Ideal Home Show and Carlo Marinetti's exhibition.
More like you were distracted by a certain Italian artist.
Violet, that's not true. The bell tinkles in the next room. Etta drops the paintbrush and the large enamel sink.
I'll go.
She shrugs out of her work smock and hands it to Violet. When I get back, we can get started on the wall mural. Mrs. Bell says she wants something primeval.
Primeval? But it's meant to be a nursery display. We're artists, Violet. Use your imagination.
She pulls aside a painted curtain to see the back of a tall man in a sharply tailored grey wool suit and a straw boater. He taps a walking stick on the wooden floor as he stands at the window, looking out at the lushly planted square across the street.
Good afternoon, sir. May I help you?
The man looks over his shoulder.
Buongiorno, signorina Etta.
Carlo!
Etta throws open her arms and runs over to the handsome Italian. He takes her into his embrace and hugs her close.
Cara mia! You become Italian, I think. Your mother would not approve.
Etta stands back and brushes a tumbling curl out of her eyes. Her finger catches on the paint-spattered kerchief she's tied over her hair.
Oh, my word! I must look a fright!
She tugs the offending scrap of fabric off her head.
This would be an impossibility.
She tucks the kerchief into her skirt pocket.
What are you doing here? I thought you were in Italy.
I was. But my exhibition here last autumn has finally, how do you say, borne fruit. Lady Cunard has persuaded her husband to meet with me to discuss a mural for the boardroom of the new Cunard building that's just been commissioned in Liverpool.
He waves his hand in the air.
It will be years before it's built, of course. But Lady Cunard is most insistent that I be involved in the design of the boardroom from the start. It is certain to give me and the architect many years of interesting arguments.
Etta claps her hands.
Oh, that's marvellous, Carlo. Everyone who's anyone travels on a Cunard liner. You will be rich and famous.
Artists do not traditionally become rich, Signorina Etta. Famous, perhaps.
He rubs his thumb and forefinger together.
But fame does not pay for spaghetti.
Etta's face crumples into a frown.
What is it, cara mia? Did you believe that I was a wealthy man? I assure you, this suit has been purchased on credit, as any decent artist would do.
No, no. Heavens, money doesn't matter to me one jot. No, I thought Lady Cunard was living in London with her daughter, Nancy, while Lord Cunard stays at their estate in Leicestershire.
She lowers her voice to a whisper.
They say she's stepping out with the novelist Mr. George Moore. Some say that Mr. Moore is Nancy's real father.
Is that so?
Oh, yes. You hear everything about everyone here at Amiga.
Outside the window, a pair of well-dressed women shuffle past the shop in their hobble skirts. They glance up at the window as they pass. Carlo takes hold of Etta's elbow and steers her deeper into the shop.
I must leave Thursday morning on the train to Liverpool to meet Lord Cunard and the architect. I was hoping you might do me the honour of accompanying me for lunch and a walk around Regent's Park tomorrow while I am in London.
He leans closer.
I miss you, Etta mia.
His eyes sweep over Etta's face.
You are as lovely as a Botticelli angel.
A delicious shiver washes up through Etta's body. Her heart jumps and flutters against her ribs like a lost butterfly. She reaches forward as if mesmerized and places her hand over Carlo's heart. He breathes in sharply and covers her hand with his own. Cara mia. The bell above the entrance door jingles, and Etta and Carlo step apart as quickly as two schoolchildren caught planning a prank. Violet appears from behind the showroom curtain. She glances at Etta, whose cheeks are colouring, and raises an eyebrow. She turns to the smartly dressed woman and her young daughter entering the shop with an effusive,
"Hello, may I be of service?"
Etta picks up a folded tablecloth.
"Yes, sir. I shall arrange for the tablecloth to be sent around to your address in the morning."
"Thank you, miss."
Carlo takes a white card and a fountain pen from his breast pocket. He scribbles on the card and hands it to Etta.
"Here is my address. I shall tell my wife to expect the package tomorrow."
Etta glances at the card. 12:30, Waterlily House, Botanic Garden, Regent's Park.
"Certainly, sir. I'm certain she will like it very much."
Carlo tips his hat and hooks his walking stick over his arm.
"Of this, I am most certain."
At 12:35 the following day, Etta enters the vast iron and glass structure that houses the water lily collection in Regent's Park. The humidity sits on the air as heavy as wet feathers, and she presses her hand against the frills of her bodice as she catches her breath. The air smells of damp and earth and moss, and it reaches inside her body, thickening her blood. She steps forward, her footsteps echoing on the damp tiled floor. Before her, hundreds of lily pads, some as large as wheels, with delicate flowers in pink and white and yellow, float in a black pool that shines like licorice under the glass roof.
"You've come. I was worried you might not."
Etta resists the urge to spin around and throw herself into Carlo's arms. She swallows and takes a breath to compose herself.
"Of course. I'm very fond of water lilies."
She feels his warm breath brush against her cheek.
"Nymphaeus."
He says the word like a caress.
"The flowers of the forest nymphs, flowers of purity and grace."
He leans closer.
"The flowers of Etta Maria."
Etta closes her eyes. His hand is on her waist, though she cannot feel its warmth through her corset. A child squeals, and Etta jolts back from the daze. Across the pool, a father lifts his young daughter over the iron railing and sits her on a large lily pad.
"Heavens! That child should fall into the water! What is her father thinking?"
"Don't worry. She will be fine. It's a Victoria water lily."
Carlo points to a description affixed to the railing.
"It says they can grow as large as 10 feet in diameter and support a weight of up to 65 pounds.
Etta looks over at the wailing child, who is slapping at the plant's rubbery green skin.
"Still, I'm sure he's not meant to be setting his child on a lily pad in Regent's Park, Carlo. She's not at all happy about it."
"You are one to follow all the rules, of course."
"Well, unless they're silly.
Like the time you ignored your parents' instruction to be home by 8:00. Etta looks sideways at Carlo and smiles prettily.
Well, it was frightfully early, and I was almost 19.
She takes a sharp breath and bites her lower lip. Carlo laughs, his teeth a flash of white under his dark moustache.
Almost 19 is a delightful age for a young woman. You'd think I was still a child, if you were to judge by the way my parents treat me. My twin sister is only 10 minutes older than me, but they let her work at the hospital at all hours, without uttering a word of objection. She could be out dancing the night away, for all they know.
You have a twin sister? It is beyond imagining that there are two Botticelli angels here in London.
Oh, Jessie's nothing like me. She has brown hair and green eyes, and she's taller and, rather sturdier than I am. And she's awfully serious. She wants to be an army nurse, but Mama is dead set against it. They've been arguing about it for months. It's awfully tedious. I had to take the job at Amiga for my own sanity. So, Jessie would not be out dancing the night away, as you say.
Oh, no, never. Etta giggles. I couldn't imagine it.
So, of course, your parents don't worry about her. But Signorina Etta, she loves to dance, does she not?
Well, yes, there's nothing wrong with that. And she enjoys the company of artists and bohemians.
They are by far the most interesting of people.
And I think Signorina Etta has a romantic heart rather than a practical one like her sister.
An artist must have a romantic heart.
If I were your father, I would be most concerned about you as well.
The smile fades from his face.
You must be careful, my angel. There are people in the world who would take advantage of such beauty. Tragedy doesn't arise from practical people, cara mia. It needs beauty and romantic hearts to nourish it.
Carlo pays the waitress and tucks his wallet inside his grey wool jacket. He's wearing a navy silk tie with flecks of green, which Etta thinks suits him very well, particularly with the jade and silver tie-pin. A crisp white handkerchief peeks from the top of his breast pocket, and his starched collar sets off the warm tan of his skin. He has slicked his black hair back from a neat side-parting, and Etta thinks she is the luckiest young woman in the cafe, having such a dashing luncheon companion. She holds her teacup between her hands and looks out from under the shade of the trellised terrace. The flower beds are bursting with ebullient peonies and bearded irises like purple spears, and the borders foam with yellow-green lady's mantle and pink-flowered geraniums. Despite it being a Thursday, the pathways are full of people enjoying the fine summer day. Nannies pushing baby carriages, children running on the grass, spinning hoops and throwing balls, an elderly gentleman walking a panting, bear-like Newfoundland dog, a woman laughing at a companion's comment.
She wouldn't have missed this day for the world. Life isn't all about studies and jobs, though her sisters appear to think so. Someone has to have some fun in life. It may as well be her.
Shall we go for a walk in the flower gardens, Etta? I've saved some bread to feed the ducks in the boating lake.
Etta sets down her teacup.
That sounds lovely.
They join the promenaders along the twisting gravel paths, stopping from time to time for Etta to sniff the perfume of a rose. Carlo cuts off a yellow bud with his penknife and slips the stem through his buttonhole.
Very dashing, Carlo.
I must be, for you.
They approach a narrow path, which veers away from the wider promenade. A small sign with an arrow directs them to the fern dell.
Shall we go? Carlo asks.
Yes, it will be nice to get out from under the sun.
They follow the path through a copse of birches, past thick banks of waxy-leafed rhododendrons with flowers the colour of blood, into the shade of the dell. A pond, constructed of moss-covered rocks, sits under the leafy green canopy of the towering plane trees and elms, and the orange scales of goldfish slide against the pond's clear surface. Carlo leads Etta to a stone bench, and they sit for a few moments in silence.
Carlo, thank you for today. It's been so lovely.
Then he is kissing her, his arms wrapped around her. She holds him tight, opening her mouth to his as he whispers her name between kisses. All she knows, all she has ever known since that first day in the art gallery, is that she loves him with every breath in her body. They walk along the path beside the boating lake, where bright blue rowboats with their happy passengers bob on the rippling water. They stop to throw scraps of bread to the honking Canada geese. When they are done, Carlo takes Etta's hand and holds it between his own. I must see you again before I go back to Italy.
Yes.
Sunday. Can you meet me?
Sunday's difficult. Everyone's at home.
Monday, then, cara mia.
Here? In the Fern Dell?
Etta nods.
Yes. That's perfect. I have art classes at the Slade on Monday, just nearby.
At 3 o'clock? It doesn't disturb your studies?
Etta smiles as she looks into Carlo's dark eyes, which shine with a light which sends a thrill through her body. I shall be thinking about you all day. How could I possibly study?
How am I meant to discuss work with Lord Cunard, when the vision of your lovely face will be all that my mind will see?
Etta feels the heat rise in her cheeks. What are we going to do, Carlo? You live in Italy, and I'm in London. It's impossible.
He squeezes her hand. It is not impossible. You are in the world, and I am in the world, cara mia. This is all that matters. We shall find a way.
Chapter 20. The Fries. Clover Bar, London, June 1914. Jessie sets the bone china teacup and saucer, her grandmother's good royal Worcester set with its delicate hand-painted flowers and gilding, as tea tastes so much better in bone china, on the wirework garden table, under the trellised arbour behind the house. She sits in a wicker chair and yawns. She'll be glad when she's back on day shifts at the hospital in a fortnight. It's an odd thing to be up while everyone sleeps, and sleeping while the world goes on its way without her. She lifts her face to the warm afternoon sun. Still, it's Sunday, and she is off. Church and lunch are done, and the afternoon is finally hers, before she heads off to an early night's sleep and the luxury of a morning lion. The door to the greenhouse swings open, and Celie steps onto the gravel path.
Tea? That's a grand idea, Jessie. Is there any left?
The teapot's in the kitchen. Bring out some of Millie's shortbread biscuits too, will you, Celie? When Celie returns, she sets the tray on the table and settles into the wicker chair beside Jessie. She picks up her teacup and sips at the hot tea. The Pearl d'Azur clematis had some wilt that I had to cut out.
I have no idea why that happened. It was perfectly healthy yesterday.
You haven't overwatered it, have you?
Not unless you've been watering it as well.
Ah, there's your answer. Too many gardeners spoil the clematis. Papa's probably been watering it too. Celie chuckles. We should probably put up a schedule in the greenhouse. She takes another sip of tea and sits quietly for some minutes.
Jessie, have you noticed anything odd when you're out in London?
Jessie licks shortbread crumbs off her lips.
What do you mean? There's all this talk about zeppelins and the Germans militarizing and people refusing to buy German sausages.
One of the windows of Steiner's haberdashers on the high street had a brick thrown through it the other night. I heard about that. I suppose it's because people are afraid. The Germans are making people nervous. Celie surveys the garden in its fulsome June beauty. Max had to join something called the Landsturm in Germany. It's like an army reserve. All the German boys have to serve when they reach their 20s. He starts his training in September when he returns to Heidelberg. It will be a year before I'll see him after that. Oh dear, how do you feel about that? It's his duty, I suppose. I keep hoping all this war talk will blow over. On a beautiful day like today, I can almost believe it will blow over and everything will return to normal. She picks at a loose piece of wicker on the arm of the chair. I'm going to miss him terribly, Jessie. A year goes by so quickly, Celie. It will be over before you know it. I suppose. She glances at her sister. I expect we shall marry when he's finished his training. Jessie sets down her teacup with a clatter. Really? He's proposed? No, please don't say anything. He hasn't asked me yet, but Max and I belong together. I felt it ever since the first day we met in German class. She smiles. I never expected to fall in love with my teacher. He isn't ancient, is he? He's only 25. I expect we shall live in Heidelberg after we marry. Perhaps I can teach English there. Isn't that a funny thing, after studying German these past 2 years, to end up teaching English? The garden door slams against the wooden fence.
Jessie! Celie! There you are! I've been looking for you everywhere.
Etta swings through the door and flops into an empty chair. She's wearing billowing peacock blue silk bloomers with a lacy white blouse, her blonde curls tumbling over her shoulders from beneath a red felt tarbouche she's set on a jaunty angle. Jessie peruses her twin. Etta, you look a sight.
I'll take that as a compliment, Miss Dowdydraws.
You're not wearing a corset, are you? Whatever will Mama think?
Corsets are bourgeois.
That's something Violet at Amiga says about boring people and things.
I guess I'm bourgeois, then.
Celie rises from her chair. I have to go. I promised to help Papa rearrange the studio this afternoon. We have several schools coming in all next week for their graduation photographs, and we won't have a moment to spare. Etta grabs Celie's arm.
What about Mama's tea for Mr. Jeffries tomorrow? You're meant to be there with me.
I'm sorry, Etta. I've told Mama I can't, as I have to help Papa. I think she was rather glad. She's convinced that Frank Jeffries fancies you. I was simply there to fill out the numbers. Etta chews her lip as Celie leaves. She leans across the table and lowers her voice.
Jessie, I need a favour.
Jessie reaches for another biscuit. Don't you have somewhere to go, Etta? It's a shame to waste your outfit on a dowdy old me. Etta grabs hold of Jessie's hand, rattling Jessie's teacup.
I'm sorry. I don't mean it, Jessie. You know me. I speak before I think. I think you're very admirable, being a nurse and all of that. I should really try to be more like you.
She smiles, her cheek dimpling.
You wouldn't credit that we're twins, would you?
What is it this time, Etta?
You must promise not to say a word to Mama or Papa.
I suddenly seem to have become the keeper of the family secrets. What are you up to?
I'm meeting someone in town tomorrow at 3 o'clock, and I'm meant to be home no later than 4 for Mama's tea for that tedious Frank Jeffries.
Ah, yes, the one who never goes to the cinematograph theatre. Mama didn't tell me a thing about it. Funny, that.
I suppose she thought you might be working, but you're doing nights now, so you're free. Can you step in for me, especially now that Celie isn't going to be there? I can't leave Mama on her own with Frank Jeffries. I'd never hear the end of it. I'll tell Mama I was delayed at the college when I get home. I shouldn't be later than 5.
Or 6-ish. Who are you meeting?
It's no one, really.
I'll not do it unless you tell me whom you're meeting. Etta puffs out a long breath.
His name is Carlo Marinetti. He's an artist. I met him at Amiga's opening party last summer.
Where are you meeting him?
What does it matter?
Jessie reaches for the teacup.
Oh, all right, Jessie. We're meeting in Regent's Park. We're simply going to have some tea and walk around the lake. Whatever's the harm in that?
What's the urgency, Etta? You can meet him another time.
He's leaving for Naples tomorrow evening. I don't know when I might see him again.
You and Celie both.
What do you mean?
You both have admirers, it appears. And I am left with Mr. Jeffreys. Jessie reaches for another of Millie's scones, choosing to ignore her mother's arched eyebrow. She splits open the golden pastry and scoops a large dollop of clotted cream and a spoonful of strawberry jam onto its warm centre. She takes a bite and dabs at her mouth with a linen napkin.
So, Mr. Jeffreys, it seems from what you said that the auction business is going well.
Frank sets down his teacup. Yes, the younger married couples in London prefer simple arts and crafts furniture to heavy Victorian pieces, though outside the city the taste is still for Victorian style. So we buy up the old pieces here, and my father sells them to the country set from our auction house in Nuneaton. He spends most of his time at our house there now, with my mother and younger brother, though he does show up unannounced in London with rather alarming regularity to take back the reins if he feels I've made an unwise purchase. Christina takes Frank's teacup and, setting the silver tea strainer over its rim to catch the fragrant Earl Grey tea leaves, pours it full of steaming tea. It's only natural for your father to keep an eye on the family business. She lifts off the strainer and scoops two spoonfuls of sugar and pours a touch of milk into the tea. She hands the teacup back to Frank. You must trust him to steer you in the right direction so that you can provide sufficiently for your future family. Yes, of course, Mrs. Fry. Jessie dabs her lips with her napkin and lays it on the table. Mama, Mr. Jeffreys, I'm afraid you must excuse me. I'm working at the hospital at 6:30, and I must get ready or I'll be late. I'm already in enough trouble with Matron about tardiness as it is. Is it that time already? Christina glances at her silver wristwatch. 5:15. Christina smiles apologetically at Frank as Jessie leaves. Etta was meant to join us this afternoon after her studies. And Miss Fry? Is she not here? Cecilia? No, she's having to help her father in the photography studio this week. They're run off their feet with graduation portraits. She rings a small silver bell on the table, just as Etta rushes into the sitting room like a gust of blonde wind. Etta unpins her hat and tosses it onto the chaise longue.
Mama, I'm so sorry. Mr. Tonks wished to see me about my piece for the college's summer exhibition, and I couldn't very well just leave, could I?
She rolls her hazel eyes dramatically.
He went on and on.
She extends her hand to Frank and flashes him her most winning smile.
Mr. Jeffreys, it's an absolute delight to see you again. I'm absolutely fraught that I missed the tea. Millie bakes the best cakes and scones in London.
Millie enters the sitting room.
Yes, ma'am?
Etta turns to the maid, who stands in the sitting room doorway, politely attentive in her neat navy dress and starched white apron.
Speak of the devil. There's our Millie now. It looks like Mr. Jeffreys is on his way, Millie. Would you kindly see him to the door?
Christina gestures to Jessie's empty chair. That's not necessary, Millie. Etta, now that you're here, come and join our guest for a cup of tea before he leaves.
I would love to, Mama, but I'm frightfully late. I'm meeting Violet at the pictures at 7 in Lewisham. I only have time for some toast and a quick bath before I have to be off.
She picks up her hat and waves at Frank.
It was lovely to see you, Mr. Jeffreys.
Millie shifts on her feet.
Mom?
I shall be off, Mrs. Fry, Frank says. Thank you for a lovely afternoon. Christina rises and extends her hand. Thank you for being such an attentive guest, Mr. Jeffreys. Please give my regards to your father. I shall endeavour to have all my daughters here the next time you visit. Millie will see you out. When Frank has gone, Christina exhales an exhausted sigh. An entirely fruitless afternoon. Frank Jeffreys' prospects as a son-in-law appear to be vanishing by the minute. She runs her fingers over her ear and pats her hair. Yet, hadn't Frank Jeffreys inquired about Cecilia? She will file that nugget of information away for the future. Once this Max Fisher is back in Germany, things will be so much easier. Christina looks at the tiered cake stand and reaches for one of Millie's walnut squares. She pops the entire square into her mouth. Closing her eyes, she savours the sweet, nutty cake as she chews, remembering a day when Harry Grenville fed her walnuts in the warm Capri sun. Before everything went wrong.